Look, if you can remove fear and ego, then you're halfway there. Fear and ego, if that gets in the way, you're in trouble. And that's another thing that I like to do, is surround myself with people that are as talented or if not more talented than myself.
Today on Dirty Linen, we are breaking out of Australia. We are going far across the world to Dubai to talk to renowned chef Greg Maloof. I am so excited to talk to Greg. He's one of Australia's most influential chefs. We're in 250 odd episodes of Dirty Linen. I feel like his name's been mentioned, I don't know, a couple of dozen times. He's got so many alumni that have filtered through great kitchens in Australia and around the world. He really changed what Middle Eastern cooking means internationally. Greg, I'm so excited to talk to you. Welcome to Dirty Linen.
Hello. Well, thank you. Greetings from Dubai, from 41 degrees at the moment, and it's 11 in the morning.
Wow. Well, I'll take a few of those degrees, but not all of them, because it's very crisp in Melbourne at the moment.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
So, Greg, tell us about life for you at the moment. What have you just been doing? What's life like in Dubai?
Well, life's not too bad in Dubai. It's almost business as usual. You know, it's been a very trying few years, I mean, globally. So they've managed quite well here. I think 90% of the population are vaccinated. So it's not so much business as usual. But, you know, there's masks and social distancing, but restaurants are operating pretty much as they were. And, you know, tourism's not where it was, but it's slowly climbing back. Also, I've been doing a bit of travel lately, which has been a real bonus for me. I've been, I think in two years I've been kind of in not lockdown situation, but on this in this part of the world or in Dubai, and haven't been able to jump on a plane. But recently I've been to Beirut and Cairo and Casablanca. So that was quite interesting and exciting, actually.
Wow. I mean, tell us more about that. I mean, I'm especially interested to hear what things are like in Beirut.
Well, yeah, I mean, Beirut's very sad. Look, it's not an easy, it was a bit emotional going there because I've got family there. And the people are not quite, I mean, they're struggling a lot. They were saying, I've been told many times that this is worse than the civil war that happened, so much worse. But look, there are people there that want to push on, and they don't want to stick their head in the sand, and so to speak, and try and push what they have and what they know as hard as they can, because money's really trapped there as well. So all the currencies. I don't know if you've heard, the currency's kind of all over the place. And so the money's kept there, and the people with some money will start investing. And I was actually there to help launch a pilot restaurant that may, if it succeeds, which I think it will, go all around the Arab world. So I went there. I've written the menus, and was training the staff there. I was there for about 2 weeks or so.
Incredible, because yeah, it's almost a year since Beirut was rocked by that terrible explosion at the port, and I mean a city in a country that was already politically quite unstable, corruption rife through every sector of the community, and of course COVID. It's really heartening to hear that somebody is opening a restaurant there. I mean, just the resilience and the optimism is just really, I mean, it's quite moving.
Yeah, look, I was, I couldn't believe it. I just said to them, listen, bring it to Dubai and we'll do it here. And they said, no, we want it to work in Beirut first and then we'll take it elsewhere. So, look, I'm hoping it'll work. I'm optimistic that it will work because it's not so much unique, but there's certain elements of it that I think the Arab world haven't seen. So let's see what happens there. And from there, that was I went to Cairo for a couple of days.
Tell me about that.
Well, that was interesting. That was a call out of the blue asking if I'd be interested in consulting or helping with a project in the pyramids.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I couldn't resist. So I went there for a few days and they showed me the project. It's an old jail that's been turned into a restaurant that it's around, 500 meters from the pyramids themselves. So it overlooks the whole, the three pyramids. It's really spectacular. And the building's very attractive. It's an old jail, which I don't know why they built a jail next to the pyramids, but they're looking at an Arab concept, contemporary kind of Middle Eastern concept. And I guess I was the only one around that could help them pull it off. So I'm in discussion with them at the moment. And I was in Casablanca before all this, doing a pilot restaurant for actually Budabar. Budabar are doing an outlet, a Middle Eastern outlet similar to Budabar, and they've asked me to write the menus and be the face of the food. So that was a pilot to see if it's going to succeed, and it's doing quite well. So it looks like Abu Dhabi and Dubai are going to be the next places they want, and then there's Saudi Arabia. So this whole region is really it's opening up with hospitality. So that's one of the reasons why I'm still here, because I really enjoy flying the flag for Lebanon and also Australia as well.
So is this what you're mostly doing? You're based in Dubai but consulting to restaurant projects around the region?
Yeah, I got too frustrated with the quality of produce. So I got out of that and set up a small kind of company that runs, that does consultancy and private events or events and private dinners and et cetera. So I find it, I quite enjoy this because I still get I still get time in the kitchen. I still get my buzz from that. And I still get a lot of buzz out of writing different menus and different styles. So there is a lot going on and I'm enjoying it.
Mm. So when you say you got frustrated with the produce, is that just in terms of sourcing ingredients from?
Well, yeah, it's just not so consistent around these parts, although it's getting better, but you know, it's very difficult to grow fresh vegetables in a country that has very little rainfall and extremes of heat. So, but they're doing quite, I'm considering all that, there's actually indoor fish farms here and a lot of progress, but you know, you can't beat gorgeous produce from Europe or England. And that's super expensive. And no, it's so they're the reasons why I got out of it, because it was too inconsistent and too expensive to deal with high quality produce. And the lower or the average product that's grown here is not you know, it's pulled out of the ground. It's not packaged as well as it could be, and it's not transported the way it should be or could be. So by the time the consumer grabs it, buys it, it's perhaps 3 days old, maybe 4 days.
Right. So you can do the fun stuff, the menu development, the concept planning, and then
training yeah.
Right. And then let the business itself
and let them,
with the soggy, well, the soggy vegetables. It's,
well, it depends. Look, there's two ways that I deal with this, and that's with intellectual property. And that's when I put someone in the kitchen that I've trained, or it could just be write the menus, train the staff, and try and steer them towards produce that's going to work. And that's pretty much it. I'll walk away from it and hope that it succeeds.
So, Greg, when you try to explain to people what it is that you bring to Middle Eastern cuisine, I mean, how do you characterize it?
Well, look, it's, I guess I start off with my heritage, but, and the fact that I was brought up in a New World country with an old cuisine. You know, the family food was very important. I mean, it's important to everyone. But it's really an interpretation. It's no, there's no fusion or there's no playing God with the cuisine itself. It's really an interpretation. So I look at the dish and hopefully keep the integrity of the dish. And whether it's Persian, Turkish, Syrian, Jordanian, North African, I don't want to play around too much with the dish. So all I'm doing is make it look a little more architectural and add a few more layers to it.
I guess there is obviously, you know, you've already expressed your desire for great produce to be part of those dishes.
Well, yeah, it's not, we're not talking foie gras and truffles. It's just good. It's just produce that's been grown properly and transported properly. You know, I do miss the days of ringing growers and fishermen. Sorry, that was not. I do miss the opportunity of talking to growers and suppliers, fishermen, butchers. Here you can't do that. You know, you're the only connection you really have is with a purchasing officer or department. And that really, I mean, that was the other reason why it frustrated me. So,
because before you moved to the Middle East, I think it was 2014, you were at Petersham Nurseries in
2012. Yeah,
was it? Yeah. You're at Petersham Nurseries, right? So where you're just basically in amongst the produce.
Absolutely. Well, they had a garden there. So, and I mean, I had a edible flower garden and herb garden and vegetables and. So, and a lot of the produce obviously was local as well, but they brought in some amazing produce from Italy, from down south. And it was all super seasonal as well. So that's a highlight for any chef. And, you know, chefs are on this planet for possibly just two reasons, and that's to cook for others and make other people content with what they're eating, and secondly, to have produce that they're proud of. There's nothing worse than a frozen piece of whatever or an old piece of something coming into your kitchen and you're already on the back foot thinking, what am I going to do with this? So, yeah.
I mean, so Petersham Nurseries, I think you took it from one Michelin star to two while you
were there. No. Just retained. No, there was an Italian... It was an Italian restaurant. I changed the cuisine, and I think they wrote in the Michelin guys wrote that on merit of of Middle Eastern food and the originality of it, we want to highlight this and keep the retain the star. So that was really about Lebanon, and it's I have to say that it is one of the great cuisines of the world, but it's almost hit a brick wall. In fact, the Arab world is cuisine has hit a brick wall, and it needs to push further. So I guess that's one reason why I'm here. And it, you know, the markets here are a lot larger. And, you know, there's a lot of people ask me, why did you leave Australia? And there's no answer, no straight answer, except I've done all I can, and the markets are too small. So hence the move.
Yeah, so for people who haven't followed your career, you were at O'Connell's in South Melbourne, which I guess is where people really so many people went through that kitchen. Middle Eastern food seemed to be really pushed into a new place by through your tenure there. And then you went to Momo, and that was another adventure again. But it's so interesting to hear you say that you think Middle Eastern food has hit a brick wall, that it needs to go further, when at the same time you're sort of saying, well, the foundations are there. I'm not really trying to change anything. I'm just trying to represent it in a certain way. I mean, is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, look, it's that's fine. That's a great way to look at it. And look, there are numerous chefs that are. I'm not alone on this. There's quite a few chefs out there with Middle Eastern backgrounds, or in fact, I know a couple of Lebanese people that are very talented in what they do. So it's a combination of what I'm trying to do and what they've achieved. I mean, some of these people I know in Lebanon have written some amazing books on contemporary Middle Eastern food, and I admire them a lot. And we're good. I'm good. Have good relationships and friendships with them. So, and also in Australia, I mean, Melbourne in particular I think one of the original places where Middle Eastern food actually took off in the right direction. And Melburnians have embraced Middle Eastern food, contemporary Middle Eastern, more than any other city I know. They just, I think at one stage, fell in love with it so much that, every second menu had something connected with the Middle East.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just normal here, and it's obviously it's so delicious. And yeah, I guess you had a lot to do with the way that it's filtered through our culinary culture. You know, as we're talking, Greg, this vision just keeps coming back to me, and it's me sitting at Momo in its second iteration in the hotel, and I've got this beautiful bastilla in front of me, and it's just like the pleating on the pastry is extraordinary. It's glossy. You can sort of tell just by looking at it, even though it's crisp and shiny, you can tell that it's flaky. I don't know how you can tell the pastry is going to be flaky from the external surface, but somehow you could. And then it's like you open it and the fragrance envelops you. And then there's just this incredible balance of crisp and soft and spice, sweet, dried fruit and cinnamon and, oh, my God, I can hardly talk because my mouth's watering too much.
Yeah. I'm in there as well. I love that dish, and it's actually quite popular around here as well, because I've never forgotten how that came about. And you know, always try it with different stuffings, whether it's duck, pigeon, chicken, even vegetarian spinach and eggplant. So It's a very versatile dish, and the technique is interesting as well.
What is it that you bring to a classic dish like a bistilla, which, you know, it's part of a lot of people's Middle Eastern heritage? But what's the Greg Maloof spin on it?
Again, there's layers. There's layers that are quite that are added to the dish. If I went to Morocco or even Tunisia and ate tagine, I mean, although they're very different, tagines from Morocco and Tunisia are quite different. But in Morocco, they're a lot sweeter, and there's plenty of bones in there as well. And I think I toned down the sweetness, and I also, because there's eggs in there as well, they scramble eggs into it to make the base for the pie. I actually make a custard, and the custard is made with the stock of the pigeon or the duck, and then when the fillings stuffed into the phyllo or brick pastry, it's put into quite a hot oven, and then the custard starts to set, and you know, it doesn't scramble or overcook, so you've got that lovely moist mouthfeel. So, and it just works with all of the rich meat, the sweetness of the dusting of cinnamon and icing sugar, and you know, the certain layers of spices. There's also almonds in there that are fried, and so yeah, there's a lot going on, but it just somehow comes together and works beautifully. I like it.
Oh, I can't stand it. I need it.
Well, I think that will I'm in Australia, I'll be doing some events at a Connells Hotel.
Well, we better just backtrack. So it's 30 years since you started at O'Connell's in South Melbourne, and you are, I'm so glad, you are coming to Australia to celebrate that anniversary.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So you're coming, and just in the start of August, you'll obviously spend a couple of weeks in quarantine hanging out. Have you got plans for quarantine? What will you be doing?
I'll be writing. I've got a contract for the Grand Prix in Abu Dhabi, so there's 40 dishes I've created, so I need to write recipes for them. So that's going to take up most of my time.
All right. Luckily, you've got 2 weeks to do that, and then you'll be doing events at O'Connell's?
Yes, late September. I think there's four events or three events at the moment. That might go to four. I think one of them's a brunch with around 10 shared dishes, and there's two dinners, again, with 10 shared dishes. And they're all different. I think the brunch will run a different menu with wines. And, yeah, I really look forward to it. I actually can't wait. I think this will be a highlight for me for a long time. There's a lot of staff that want to come and eat and actually help. And there's a lot of guests that I've known over the years that keep saying, when are you coming back, or we miss O'Connell's, or we miss Momo. So it's about time I did something or gave back to O'Connell's. I mean, they gave me a lot over 10 years.
Well, we'll just have to keep ourselves out of lockdown for that period because we definitely need to experience your food again. Hopefully we'll be all right. Greg, what is it? I mean, so many people that have worked with you speak with, you know, just with such gratitude and awe about the time that they spent sort of learning from you. What is your approach to teaching and training?
Well, it's, look, if you can remove fear and ego, then you're halfway there. Right? It's just, it's as simple as that. And just focus on, I mean, that's with most industries anyway, but fear and ego, if that gets in the way, you're in trouble. They're my thoughts. And I've been lucky enough to surround myself by some very talented people, and whether they're technicians or creators. And that's another thing that I like to do, and it is surround myself with people that are as talented, or if not more talented than myself.
And so that's where the ego is. Like you don't mind if somebody outshines you.
Yeah, look, I don't. Maybe years ago when I was a kid, yeah, we all have egos and whatever, but. You know, I think that was beaten out of me at an early age. So now think that there's no real place for it. And I know many chefs globally that don't subscribe to that at all. They go the other way. Fear and ego, which does, for me, doesn't make sense. So.
Do you think having that attitude has helped you progress with your own cooking and the way that you think about food?
Look, when I think about food, I think about travels. I think about family values, friendship values. You know, there's a lot of things going on, and I might be triggered to write a dish if I'm walking through a market and see some lamb's tongue or you know, a humble eggplant. There's something might trigger me to, I guess create something. But I think chefs in general, if they can create one original dish in their lifetime, they probably made it. So that's a tough one.
Have you done that?
No. Everything's got. I could say that salmon kibinay was a thing that I made in 1994, and I still can't get enough of it. And I think I got the approval of my mother at the time, because she just thought that the things that I was doing were a little wacky. But when she ate that, she just thought, wow, this is... this is something else. So that that helped a lot.
Was that a gateway to further approval?
Well, it's just one approval. That's all I needed. That was it. Yeah. I didn't want to argue about anything else. No.
Yeah. Greg, I'd love to ask you about your health, because I know that you don't have your original heart in your body. can you tell me?
The heart of a 28-year-old.
Is that what you've got?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, there's not much to tell. I had a checkered history of health issues and just got back up. And I was told several times that I shouldn't be cooking. And then I think every time I was told that, I went forward and wanted to cook. So... now it's things are monitored very well. I had two heart transplants. The first one, I don't know. I think I just didn't look after myself all that well. The second one, I thought, no, I need to deal with this properly. So it was about diet and a regime and exercise and. There is drug therapy, immune suppressant therapy that I can't stop. And generally now, I've lost quite a bit of weight now, and I try and be as active as I can, whether I'm walking or I mean, in the kitchen, I think I've monitored around 8,000 to 10,000 steps or so, which is not too bad. And it's really, I've controlled what I eat. So, you know, there's no late night binging and drink and bowls of noodles and things like that. So I've stopped all that. I actually get up in the morning quite early, have some yogurt and fruits, a light lunch, and just a grill and whatever for dinner. I don't go out a lot here because I kind of get disappointed a little bit, and it's super expensive. And so I go and buy produce, and I cook at home a lot. So, and I can control my diet and whatever quite easily here. And actually, when I was in lockdown, that was great because I just stopped everything and I just controlled myself. And I think I lost around 8-9 kilo through lockdown.
Oh, I think I got them.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
Is there anything about having the heart of somebody else in your body that goes beyond it just being a bit of biological machinery that makes your blood flow? Like, is there any feeling of having someone else's heart?
No. There was at the start when I was a lot younger. I kind of freaked out a little bit. But now, no, I don't think about it. If someone mentions do you have any health issues? I generally say, no, look, a bit of cholesterol. But if someone's delving into my history, then, yeah, I can say that I don't relate to – I relate to the heart as something that's life-saving and has made me probably a better person in that I can continue what I do. Continue my life's work and continue, I guess, entertaining in a kitchen.
Why does it make you a better person?
Well, I think as a kid you're invincible and you want to do everything and anything. And at one stage I thought I could, and no, I was just had that egotistical kind of side of me creep up, and you know, it's a potentially destructive. So I slowed down a lot when I was ill and just decided, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go down that path. But it's not connected to, there's no emotional connection with the donor, although I did receive a letter from someone on my second transplant, and they were convinced that I had their husband's heart because they followed my career and knew that I had a transplant at a certain time, and their partner passed away in, I think, a car accident, and thought that I was the recipient. And so that really did freak me out. It was quite a shock to read this. It was a handwritten 2-page letter. So I gave it to the hospital, the Alfred, and they checked it out and said, no, it's not it. And I said, well, what shall I do? And they said, don't respond. We'll respond for you. And so that was that. And that was probably the most emotional. That was that triggered a lot of things, I think.
Yeah, that is very intense. I mean, it's obviously for the person who was writing that letter, she'd lost that person. So, yeah, but it's, I guess, does that make you part of that person's story, or is it, it's all your story? It's, I can see that it would throw up a lot of questions and narrative threads, but, I'm glad that, I'm just glad that it's possible to do those things, and that your heart is, your blood is still flowing and a heart is beating in your body. Greg, I really do wonder what you're going to think of Melbourne. We've been through the wars a little bit, as have so many parts of the world, pretty much the whole world.
That's all right. Look, I've just come back from Beirut, so nothing is severe as that.
Yeah, it's not Beirut. I really would just love to finish with a little bit of a description of the brunch, because I haven't eaten one of your brunches. What kinds of things could we expect?
Well, I was told not to mention any dishes, but
just no one's listening. Just a little sneaky one.
Oh, look, it's a mixture of old and new. It's a mixture of what I was doing back then in 1991 and what I'm doing now, which, you know, there's common threads, but the look is very different. And it has to be. I mean, 30 years has gone by, so there's some interesting stuff going on with dishes. You know, I've even, you know, such a classic like pavlova's been twisted in a way that has, I guess, some Arabic flavors to it. And the look of it is very different as well. It looks like something out of a Ramadan tent. So there's things that are current with me. And as I was saying, there's a lot of older dishes, but you will see the bisteya, and you will see the salmon kibbeh, but they'll be presented a little bit differently. What else can I say without revealing too much? There's probably a few different ingredients that that are intriguing. So, you know, it's something that I really look forward to.
Great.
I do.
Yeah, well, I do as well. I'm really, really excited that we'll get to see you in Melbourne before too long. Thank you so much for chatting today. It's just, I really feel like I've had a little bit of a jaunt around the Middle East with you, which is extremely welcome. I talk to you from my restricted circumstances in Melbourne. Travel safe and we'll see you here before too long.
Yes, look, I'll be in Australia early next month, having fun in quarantine, and then I look forward to seeing my family and friends and eating out. That's the other thing that I miss so much, eating out in Melbourne. Wow.
Wow. Yeah. Well, restaurants will be very glad to welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you, Danny.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Cheers. Bye-bye.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you.
This.